Welcome to Puentes, Bridges to the Community. Hello, I'm your host, Emily Guerra. My guest on this edition is award-winning filmmaker and producer of the PBS documentary series Latino Americans, John J. Valadez. It is the first major documentary series for television that chronicles the history and experiences of Latinos in the United States who helped create America. By the end of November, he will have visited 50 schools and universities to talk about the six-hour documentary series Latino Americans. KRWG-TV will encore the documentary starting tonight at 8 o'clock for the next six Saturdays. Valadez has been producing and directing award-winning documentaries for CNN and PBS for the past 20 years. I begin the interview by asking him to talk about his background. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got started. Was this a dream as a child to be a filmmaker?
Well, not really. I grew up in Seattle, and Seattle is kind of exactly the opposite of Las Cruces. And what I mean by that is it rains. We have rain, and then we have more rain, and then we have more rain. And as a result, we have what you would call a kind of a coffee shop culture. You know, Starbucks comes from Seattle. And so when I was growing up, we would get tanked up on lots of coffee, and we would hang out in the coffee shops. And in all over Seattle at that time, the coffee shops had little movie theaters attached to them, little revival house movie theaters. And so because it was always raining, we would drink coffee and we would go and we would see, you know, the films of Ingmar Bergman. We would see Bernardo Bertolucci. We would see old John Ford westerns. We would see the Charlie Chaplin films. We would see films by Akira Kurosawa. And we would see basically the history of world cinema, and we would see hard-hitting documentaries that would come out. And so we became a very movie and film literate.
So this was in your teens and then on to college?
Yeah, and then I went to the University of Washington, went there for a year. And it was kind of funny because when I got into the University of Washington, my mom came to take me to school, to move into the dorm, Lander dorm. And I was on the eighth floor. And so she was helping me, and I had my boxes. I was all excited and stuff. And so the door of the elevator opens for the eighth floor. And right on the wall, as the door opened, there was this big mural of some kind of like Indian-looking dude. And it said, Bienvenidos Chicano House. And I was horrified. I mean, because, you know, my entire life I was trying to get away from all things Mexican. I just wanted to be John. I didn't want to be... But somebody had seen my last name and put me in this place, Chicano House, which I was just totally embarrassed to be there. And, you know, and my mom was like, well, you know, what's this, you know? And Chicano was not a word in our vocabulary. So, and I was just, it was not where I wanted to be. So, but I, you know, I spent the first year there. You know, I met the people on the floor, and they were really cool, and it was great. But I ended up dropping out of school. After about a year and a half, I found myself in, you know, freshman courses with like 300 people. And it just wasn't the kind of education that I saw myself getting. It was kind of depressing, actually. So I quit. I became a Latino dropout statistic.
Although you didn't consider yourself in that Hispanic or Latino category?
Well, obviously other people did, even though I didn't, right? So I worked for a while, and I thought, oh, you know, what am I going to do? And then through a friend of a friend of a friend, I heard about a school in central India. And somebody suggested, because I was into photography, I loved photography, that I apply to teach photography at this small rural village school in central India. So I wrote them a letter, and I applied, and they said, yeah, you know, come on out. And so I got a ticket to go to India, and traveled across the U.S., went to New York, then from New York flew to Paris, spent a week in Greece, spent a month in Israel, and then finally ended up in India. And while I was in India, I worked at this small rural village school, and they gave me the students who could speak English because most people there spoke Hindi. And it was in a very remote, part of India. They had never seen Americans, or so they told me. And so we built a dark room, and I showed the kids how to process film and how to print pictures with the enlarger and how to mix the chemicals, and it was wonderful. And then one evening, my students came to me and they said, Mr. John, that's what they called me. They said, the villagers in Susera, the next village over, would like to meet you. And I was like, okay, no, it sounds great. And so we walked through the jungle about a kilometer to the village, and the villagers had built a huge bonfire, and they had pulled their beds out from their earthen huts. And around the bonfire, they were all sitting on these beds, and so I was invited to sit there too. And the villagers began telling me stories, and my students translated into English. And they were stories of gods and goddesses, Hanuman and Ganesh and Lakshmi and Vishnu and Shiva and Krishna and Brahma. And all of these stories were like, they were like parables, little parables about what it is to lead a life well-lived and what it is to lead a life squandered. And you could see sort of the values of their community through these little stories. And they were remarkable and wonderful and inspiring. And I didn't know anything about Hinduism. Where I come from, we have one God, and over here they have hundreds. So coming back from the village, I began to think about the United States. And I thought, what happened to our sense of community? You know, we seem so fractured and divided all the time. And what happened to our ability to, well, you know, gather around the fire and tell the story of our people? It seems like somehow with modernity, we had lost touch of something. And it struck me that we do gather around the fire. We gather around a burning box. And that burning box is television. And we gather around a burning wall. And that burning wall is cinema. And it is through those fires that we tell the story of our people, that we try to make sense of the world, that we try to figure out what it is to lead a life well-lived and what it is to lead a life squandered. And so I decided that evening there in Madhya Pradesh in central India that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to become a filmmaker, that I wanted to figure out somehow how to tell the story of my people.
Here you were at a young age of?
20.
And so then how did you then become a filmmaker?
So I came back to the U.S. I come from a family of field workers. Because in Eastern Washington, where my family's from, is a lot of agricultural work. So, you know, Mexican-American field workers. And so, you know, my family didn't have much in the way of money. I mean, we were okay, but we weren't rich. So I came back and I decided, well, you know, there's a way to make a lot of money. And that's you can work on a fishing boat up in Alaska. People told me you can make big bucks. So I got hired on to work up in Alaska, and what I found out is that I get seasick. So I was like, I was terrible. I was sick all the time. I was doped up on Dramamine 24/7. It was a horrible experience. But what I did while I was on the boat in between bouts of nausea is I applied to film school. I heard that there was a film school in New York City at New York University, Tisch School of the Arts, and it was all these famous filmmakers had gone there. So I thought, well, that's where I want to go. So I applied, and for some ridiculous reason, they let me in. And so I quit my job out in the Aleutian Islands and flew to New York City and started my sojourn at New York University as a film student. Now, I'll just take the story one more step further, which is to say, when you get into film school, you have to make films. Okay, that's what they require of you, and it's brutal. I think the first year we had to make 12 films, and by the first year, I think probably 70% of the students dropped out because it was so difficult. So after you do that, you have to make your thesis film. So I was thinking, what can I do? You know, I wanted to make a feature film, but, you know, when you make a feature film, you have to make it all at one time because you have actors, you have to have continuity, and I didn't have any money, really. And so I couldn't afford to shoot for 4 weeks and pay for everything. So I figured what I could do is I could make documentaries, because documentaries, you can shoot for a day, then in 2 weeks you could shoot for a day, and then you could save up some more money, and then in a month you could shoot for a day, so that the economics of a longer time horizon actually work in your favor. So I started making a film with my professor's permission. I saw an article in the Village Voice about a former leader of the Black Panther Party who was claiming that he was falsely imprisoned in upstate New York. And so I started, and he was saying these crazy things. He was saying that he had been framed by the U.S. government, and that he had been in prison for 19 years, 8 of those in solitary confinement, and that the U.S. government had a secret program to destroy political dissent in the United States called COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program. And it was aimed at political radicals during the 1960s. So I told my professor about this. He approved the project. And so I started making this film. I didn't know anything about the Black Panthers, about the 60s, but it just seemed interesting. The Panther's name was Daruba. I get a call from Daruba's attorney, and he says, John, Daruba's going to have a hearing before the New York State Supreme Court up in Albany, and I checked it out, and it turns out that they allow cameras. Why don't you and the other students go up there and see if you can, you know, film? Might be interesting. So, you know, all of us, we piled into a van, and we went up to Albany, and we set up our camera, and the gallery was filled with people. And Daruba comes in, and there's the judge, and almost right away, the judge lifts his gavel and hits his gavel, and he orders the immediate vacation of the conviction because of prosecutorial misconduct, and the gallery goes nuts. This guy walks out a free man after 19 years in prison, and basically what the judge was saying is that, there was some monkey business going on. So we took this footage to public television and showed it to some people, and wrote up some grant proposals and such. And PBS gave us a check for $250,000. And we made the film. We didn't pay ourselves a dime.
By we, how many of you were involved?
Like, you know, 5 of us, students. And it received a primetime national broadcast on PBS. This was 1993, I think. And it was nominated for an Emmy. And after that experience, I decided, well, you know what? I guess I'm a filmmaker.
And so then the themes for now the Latino programs, which are on PBS, this came much later. How many more films did you do after this one about the Black Panthers?
Oh, I think to date I've done probably 11 feature-length documentaries for national broadcast on American television. So with the Latino American series, I produced 2 hours of the 6-hour series.
What led you to it?
I think all of us who worked on the series, we have had a longing to make a series like this for a long time. American broadcast television began back in 1939. And so we've had 74 years of American broadcast television in this country. And never has there been a nationally broadcast series that attempts to tell the story of Latinos in this country and the role that we have played in building this nation, the contributions we've made in helping create the American mind. And we've never seen a narrative that begins to weave our story into the larger story of our country. And now, finally, the time is here. And I think it's a proud moment for all Americans, not just for Latinos, because Latino history is American history. And it's good for all of us. It's our shared and common legacy. And so I think it's a good moment for the country.
When you were going to school, in grade school, did you ever study Latino history? Was it ever taught?
No, it was excluded. It was dismissed. It was minimized. It was ignored. It was devalued. It was not included. it was as though Latinos had played no role in creating this country, that we had played no meaningful role in fighting for civil rights, that we had played no meaningful role in fighting for democracy against totalitarianism in World War II, that we'd played no role in the labor movement, that we were invisible. We were relegated to the dustbin of history and were never recognized as full participants in this great American story.
But at that age, as a youth, were you aware that there was no history being taught about Latinos?
Oh, yes.
All of these things that you were saying?
Absolutely. Kids are smart. I picked up on it right away. But you know what you do is you pick up on it and then you try to create an explanation for that absence. And the explanation that I created in my mind was that the teachers are really smart, so they're teaching us the things that are important and they're leaving out the things that are not important. And they're leaving out the people who don't matter and the people who haven't really contributed anything.
And do you think that students to this day are being taught the same thing?
Well, since this is the first time that a series such as this is airing on national television, I can only assume that we're not where we need to be.
What would you like for students and the viewing public to take away from this series?
I think what they should take away, at least in my dreams, right, is to say, look, I grew up and I have a tremendous respect and affinity for Southern culture. Right? That's an American identity to be from, you know, to be from Georgia. It's a beautiful thing. And it's a beautiful thing to be, a Texan from Fort Worth. Right? And it's a beautiful thing to be an Italian from Brooklyn. That's American, too. And it's a beautiful thing to be a Jew from Long Island. That's a beautiful thing. And it's a beautiful thing to be a Yankee from Boston, a New Englander. That's an American identity as well. And what I hope is that people watch this series and they say, yeah, you know what? Latino is American too. And it's just as American as those other identities. It's another flavor, another twist, another ethnicity in this bundle of ethnicities in this crazy place we call the United States. And this incredible diversity is beautiful and it's a strength. Yeah, Latinos are not newcomers. They're not foreigners. They're Americans.
Now, were your parents born in Washington as well, or did they come from Mexico?
No, my parents are from Washington State.
And your grandparents?
Colorado. And El Paso. And so to go back to my roots in Mexico, which I believe are in Guanajuato, you have to go back some serious generations, pre-1848, which was the U.S.-Mexico War. So, it's almost a cliche to say this, but it's really true. My family really didn't immigrate to the U.S. The U.S. immigrated to us.
Yeah, like some say, well, we didn't cross the border crossed us.
Yeah, and that's an American story. It's neither good nor bad. It just is, and it's who we are, and it's the legacy we've inherited, and let's talk about it. And sometimes it's painful and kind of uncomfortable, but heck, it's our legacy and it's our heritage. And I think as Americans, we're big enough, we can handle it.
And is the series going to be translated in Spanish or will it just be in English?
It's available in Spanish. All the DVDs have a Spanish language version. I believe it's going to be broadcast in Spanish.
Do you yourself speak Spanish?
Oh, no. Are you kidding? I grew up in an era. Remember, I didn't learn about Mexican-American participation in the American story. So all things, when I was growing up, all things Mexican were bad. Mexicans were lazy. They were shiftless. They were involved in the drug trade. They were just, they were ornery.
What you had been told.
This is sort of the cultural milieu in which I grew up. And of course, that contradicted my life at home, with my cousins and my aunts and uncles who were all really terrific people. They were a heck of a lot of fun and I love them dearly and they weren't antisocial. So you have this weird, odd juxtaposition of realities that don't seem to mesh, and you have to try to reconcile why what you're seeing with your own eyes and through your own family experience is contradicting what the broader mainstream American society is telling you.
And don't you think that that's true not just with the Hispanic American or Latino American, but with a lot of other nationalities that have come in since then as well, like Koreans and Chinese and the Japanese when they were put into camps here in the United States?
Oh, yeah. I mean, boy, thank goodness I'm not a Muslim today. I think that would suck, you know, honestly.
But have you been asked if you are?
No, I've never been asked. But yeah, certainly. I mean, why do we have Chinatowns in San Francisco and in New York? It's because once upon a time, they were sequestered and they were told they could only live in certain places, right? We had the Chinese Exclusion Act. You know, America has had an ongoing race and ethnicity problem from the beginning, one which we're still grappling with. But I don't know, it's important to talk about it. It's the world we live in.
So how do you get the subject matter for your Latino series? How did you go about researching? Where did you go?
Boy, well, okay, two things. One thing is fortunately for all of us, we have Chicano studies, Mexican American studies, ethnic studies, Latino studies departments at colleges and universities across the country. And because of those departments, there are incredibly brilliant and dedicated scholars and academics who have researched and really excavated this history and resurrected it from being lost. And, you know, and I know we're in an age right now where in Arizona, Mexican American studies is not appreciated. And in the state of Texas, there are also movements to, you know, cut it back or eliminate it. And that is so un-American. I got to tell you, it's really un-American. It smacks of censorship. And because these Mexican American studies departments are good for everybody, because Mexican American history is American history. It's about all of us. And that is our common cultural legacy. And we need to understand it and preserve it. So when I was doing research for this series, I relied really heavily on these brilliant scholars who are doing amazing work. In fact, we could not have made this series had it been not for ethnic studies and Mexican American studies programs across the country. So my approach in particular, and I think sometimes scholars get a little upset at me, but our approach is really to tell stories of people. And through their individual stories, then we get a bigger picture of what society was like at the time. So, for example, one of the stories in the World War II film that I did with my partner Dan McCabe is about Macario Garcia. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's from Texas. He was a Mexican national who was working as a cotton picker, a field worker, when the war broke out. And he went and he volunteered to join the army in the United States, even though that wasn't his country. And he was sent to Europe, came right after D-Day, and found himself in some of the fiercest fighting of the European theater. The U.S. Army was pushing into the heartland of Germany, and they were stalled at the Hürtgen Forest, where German machine gun emplacements had withering fire and were just cutting down Americans left and right. People were just dying all over the place. Horrible, bloody fighting. And it stopped the American advance. Well, Macario Garcia gets shot in the shoulder, goes, sneaks behind enemy lines, finds a machine gun emplacement that's killing Americans, kills all of the soldiers in it single-handedly, the German soldiers, comes back down, gets shot again. He sees that there's another machine gun killing Americans, sneaks around the back, gets up there, kills all the Germans, takes out two machine gun emplacements, gets shot twice, almost dies. He's a bloody mess. And he literally saved the lives of his entire company by getting rid of those machine gun nests and allowed the Americans to push into the heartland of Germany at the Hürtgen Forest. And so for that, he was awarded the Medal of Honor by President Truman. the first Mexican national to receive that honor in World War II. Well, 2 weeks later, he's back down in Houston, where he was living at the time before the war. And he had been honored at the City Hall in Richmond. And he got off a bus and was in uniform after being celebrated. I mean, he's like a rock star, okay? Everybody knows him. He walks into a diner and is refused service. No Mexicans allowed. And that refusal of a Medal of Honor winner became the first salvo in the fight for civil rights right after the war. And that would be the opening shot in the battle, not in Europe or the Pacific, but the battle for civil rights for Mexican Americans at home. You know, a lot of times people think that documentaries are boring, that they're something you have to watch. But I think in this case, this series, it's just a damn good story. I mean, it's, you know, buckle your seatbelts on this one. I mean, it is fun, it is challenging, and it'll give you something to talk about.
And be another bridge to the community.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think this series really will function, I hope, as a way to span divides of difference and find new connections for positive change and understanding. And I'm super excited. It's 6 hours, and it will shock and inspire. It'll make you feel uncomfortable at times, but most of the time, I think what it'll do is it'll make you feel proud.
Award-winning documentarian John Valadez, thank you for joining me on Puentes.
Muchas gracias.
You can watch Part 1, Latino Americans, Foreigners in Their Own Land, Empire of Dreams, tonight at 8 on KRWG-TV. Please visit our website, krwg.org, and click on Puentes for this interview and others. For KRWG, I'm Emily Guerra.